series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll screen the documentary film Circle of Poison on Thursday, March 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Once a pesticide is banned in the United States for its dangerous health and environmental effects, companies are still permitted to manufacture it for export only. Circle of Poison documents the export of dangerous pesticides and the inspiring ways communities are fighting back. Again, that's Circle of Poison on Thursday, March 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland, and The Radioactivist is up next. It's 9 a.m. and you're listening to KBOO Community Radio. This is The Radioactivist. I'm Lisa Loving and I'm here with my friend and compatriot Suzanne LeGrand.
Hello.
Today, The Reluctant Radical is a new documentary telling the story of oil pipeline protester Ken Ward. We're spending the hour with Ken and film producer and director Lindsay Grazel. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
If I misspeak, correct me, okay? Because I'm just, the world feels really thin to me today. These are just odd times. I feel like I just keep looking over my shoulder today. This documentary film, The Reluctant Radical, screens tonight at St. Philip the Deacon Episcopal Church. It's over there at 120 Northeast Knott Street. The doors open at 7, I think we agreed. And the film shows, and it's followed by a big discussion. So for anyone who's thinking, I'm putting this out, for anyone who's thinking about breaking the law in a big way, for social change and documenting it in film, you need to be squinting your ears for this hour because this is a wild case. And when we talk about breaking the law and how Ken, what happened to Ken in court, this is really crucial. So I just wanted to start out and just hand the microphone to Ken and say, Ken, how did you get involved in this issue?
Well, let's see. I've been involved in climate change for a very long time. I spent 20 years or a little bit more than 20 years as a professional staff person for public interest and environmental organizations. And I worked both for Greenpeace and also in the Ralph Nader Network working on climate change in the late 80s. I took a leave of absence from doing professional work to be an at-home dad. And while I was in the process of sort of getting ready to go back to work, I seized the opportunity to research climate change, which struck me as the biggest problem facing us. And I kind of delved deeply into the science in a way that most activists don't generally have a chance to do because, you know, you're doing your work. So I had the chance to kind of read the original science and came to the conclusion then, this was in early 2000s, that the work that we were doing as professional environmentalists was wasn't sufficient. You know, we simply weren't comprehending the scale of the problem or the size of political change that would be necessary to have any chance of addressing it. And so I began to write and to organize, trying to sort of create a pressure group with inside mainstream environmentalism that would apprehend the scale of the problem. This is a long-winded answer, but took a while to get to action. So that one part of that was to conclude that a central thing that's missing in the U.S. political context was direct action. Was disruption around climate change, was we just didn't have enough people going out there to say that this is not a problem that's that we can address through incremental changes. We need to fundamentally, you know, change how society thinks about the relationship between people and the environment, and especially the atmosphere. And after a couple of years of sort of calling on other people to engage in direct action and hoping others would do it, it just didn't happen. So I decided I kind of have to do it myself. So that's how I got to it.
I'm sitting here trying to think of who I even remember speaking about climate change in the early 2000s. I'm sitting here just trying to think about who was even talking about it.
Well, Al Gore, when did his...
Yeah, maybe Al Gore.
Al Gore. It was a very lonely time. I mean, for a while there, the only two people that I had any significant conversations with was Bill McKibben. The Ross Gelb's band was also a writer at the time coming out of the Boston Globe. And I used to send him like little emails or call him up going, This seems like a really big deal. And they're like, yeah, it is.
Yeah. If you just tuned in, this is The Radio Activist. We're live in the studio with Ken Ward and film director Lindsay Graizel. We didn't really put this, we weren't explicit about this yet. The reason Ken is in this room is because he went over to one of these gigantic tar sands pipelines. I think it was in Washington State. Actually had a... I almost said something obscene, a great big tool and actually closed the oil valve. This is kind of like, you know what? There were the swords into plowshares, Roman Catholic nuns and stuff who would take like big tools and pound on nuclear warheads because they were making swords into plowshares, which is very symbolic. This is like that, but more so, I'd say it was more so. And this happened in 2016. I want to turn to Lindsay Graizel, the documentary filmmaker who walked with Ken and was there when this stuff happened. Lindsay, how did you come to this issue of climate change, global warming? Why did you make this film?
Well, I had been concerned about climate change when I met Ken in 2015, but certainly not to the degree that I am now. And the beginning of that change happened because of a conversation with Ken. I didn't think of global warming and climate change at the time as an issue that was potentially going to wipe people off the map or, you know, halt civilization. I thought of it kind of the way I think of plastic in the ocean now, like an overwhelming, terrible thing, and we're not quite sure where it's going to lead. But I don't think of... I didn't think of it in terms of something that was really an existential threat. And a lot of that was because I wasn't really up on the science and how fast it was changing, and I had never read those papers that Ken had read. After talking to him, I started to think about it differently, and his personal story of what he went through in terms of working within the environmental movement and then stepping, you know, outside of it in a more radical fashion to pursue direct action, I thought was extremely compelling as a documentary filmmaker. So it was really Ken's story, his personal path, that led me to make the film. And we started filming in 2015. At the time, I thought it was going to be a short film. That's what Ken had signed up for. He had already done an incredible direct action at the time, blocking a shipment of coal to the Brayton power plant, in Massachusetts. And so my vision was to make a 10 or 15 minute film about Ken's life and how he got to be pursuing direct action and showcase the lobster boat action. But no sooner had he agreed to participate in that Shell Oil announced that they were bringing the Fenica to Portland for repairs. And Ken told me he had a plan to stop that ship. And so I decided to start filming in real time. And then we ended up filming together for 2 years.
It's amazing because valve turners, we're talking about valve turners right now, which is its own. It's an incredible way of protesting.
Is it a thing?
It is a total thing. Huh. And in fact, I just went online and just typed in the phrase valve turners, okay? 3 days ago, okay, at CBS Minnesota had a big story. This was actually March 9th. Companies decry valve turners who shut down pipelines. It's totally a thing. This is a different group of valve turners as Enbridge prepared to move climate-damaging tar sands crude through a 40-year-old pipeline in eastern Canada in 2015. Environmentalists and Indigenous peoples, including Vanessa Gray, thought about what happened in Michigan just 5 years earlier. All these, just every... Does every oil pipeline break? Does every one break? Does every one leak? What about the one that... I know, now I'm spinning out. Like, this story, it becomes so big. And yet we, as everyday people, we don't even hear enough about the actual radical things people have done to try to disrupt the oil industry as it is basically bringing oil all the way across in multiple places. The continent. I mean, we're talking about pipelines full of toxic chemicals that we consume, like they're going out of business, right? Like there is no tomorrow. We're consuming them like there's no tomorrow. Hello. But it just gets me that of, you know, we talk about media, we talk about mainstream media. What do people know and what they don't know? Suzanne, you were going to ask a question.
Yeah, I just wanted to go back to what you said earlier about doing research and coming to the conclusion that what the environmental movement was doing wasn't enough. And I'm wondering if you could just talk about what you discovered or what weren't they doing that was enough, or what is the wider scope that we need to understand?
Well, first, I myself did no research. I simply read the research of actual scientists. Which is something we don't generally have time to do if you're a professional advocate. I mean, you read some of it, but in particular, I read the initial paper from Dr. James Hansen that was based, it's called The Slippery Slope. And in that, he walked through the sequence of what happens when we put enough carbon into the atmosphere, which so warms the atmosphere warms the oceans. The oceans then begin to disintegrate the ice, these giant ice shelves in Greenland and Antarctica. We face a whole slew of other problems coming out of climate change, but it is that sequence of sort of unstopping these massive ice shelves that is our biggest challenge. And that's actually happening. So what was laid out in the early 2000s as a matter of conjecture, we're living through right now. Large chunks of Antarctica and Greenland. I noticed recently that in the latest news about what's happening in Antarctica, scientists are increasingly making the comparison to the island of Manhattan as a appropriate size of what's happening in Antarctica. So large spaces underneath the Thwaites Glacier, the size of Manhattan, have been hollowed out by warm water. Large pieces of the ice shell, floating ice shells, are breaking off that are as big as two Manhattans, so massive amounts of ice here. All of that, leads to many, many feet of sea level rise, which is already in the works. The question is only how quickly is that going to happen? I mean, we're already in a situation where the West Antarctic ice shelf is described by scientists as being an unstoppable collapse. That's 32 feet. Now, that's going to play out over thousands of years at the moment, but projected. But we don't really know how quickly, because it's so far, it's happening so much faster than. Anyway, so that was sort of outlined in the early 2000s. And the only thing that environmentalists were doing at that time was to encourage lifestyle changes, change your light bulbs, buy a Prius, and to advance sort of minor policy. It was called cap and trade type policies, which would nobody thought would have any major impact on reducing carbon emissions. So to go, to comprehend the scale of what of the change that would need to occur, if you're in a professional, moderate incremental based organization, it requires you to then say, well, we can't do it through this organization, and I can't do it through my job, mm-hmm. and most people are unwilling to take that step.
And the larger
I should say, by the
scale,
way, I didn't volunteer to do this; I was still looking to be hired and working in jobs, so I didn't.
Right. And the larger scale things that you see we actually need to do to change this or to attempt to address it, what would those larger scale things be that are not happening maybe even today within organizations? And you mentioned direct action, but just, are there other, what's your vision of what actually needs to happen?
Well, I think the first step is to be willing to describe the scale of the problem. I mean, we literally aren't doing that at the moment. As mentioned earlier, it's still basically up to the individual to try to figure out what's actually happening here. So if the very first step of advocacy is to define the problem, we have absolutely failed to do that. Scientists are doing their best, but so that's the first step. Once you've done that, once you've said, then, you know, this is the scale of the problem, then we also need to begin to articulate what's the scale of the, you know, of an appropriate solution here. People often reference World War II as being an example of the kind of size of an effort that we need to see, but rarely do we actually follow that through to say, yeah, here's what happened in World War II. World War II, the U.S. did nothing, you know, leading up to it. Then we got bombed. Immediately after we got bombed, the president called in, for example, the heads of the four major auto companies and said, this, you know, in December, you are going to stop making cars and trucks by the end of January, and then you're going to start making tanks and planes.
And then we're going to rearrange complete shipyards just to serve that. Yeah. It's interesting to me.
And we're also going to require people, we're going to tell people you're not going to consume as much.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, what strikes me is, I mean, I think we do have leadership on this issue. There's not a lot of leadership, but there's some. But I feel like the media is part of the problem, and I'm saying that as a media person. Like, there are people who have been describing in detail what the issue is. And then we'll see that random video of the polar bear starving to death. Remember that video? It pops up and then it disappears, right? So World War II, at least, like, we had some bad guys. But in this case, we're our own bad guys. But I have to say, I'm not really seeing, I'm going to put out, like, daily newspapers or TV stations making this issue so that people can understand it. And that's why it's so remarkable, the film that Lindsay made. Like, because we're talking about a documentary. It's going to be playing tonight at St. Philip the Deacon Episcopal Church, be there at 7 p.m. But we're talking about how to explain to an unwilling public, you know, our own culpability and what we should do. And there is no single thing that we can do that's remarkable. And I do want to go back to Lindsay and talk a little bit more about what you see as the information that's coming out. But here I am again. I'm on CBS Local in Minnesota last month. Four activists tried to do a valve turning thing for Enbridge Oil Pipeline. That is the company that's connected to Standing Rock. You know, Standing Rock was huge. It was this huge political camp at a place to try to block the creation of an oil pipeline, but it failed. And there's others that have emerged, but we don't even know where. We haven't heard about them. And I've met Bill McKibben in the hallway of KBOO Community Radio. There's an organized harassment campaign of Bill McKibben. There's a group of people. There's an unnamed group. They harass him everywhere he goes, physically and psychologically. And he talked about it in the hallway. He wasn't that interested in talking about it on the air. But it's like, this kind of comes down to us and how we live and what we will accept. And that just fascinates me. People are still valve turning. And we are talking about October of 2016, when Ken, Lindsay, you were there, a whole group of people from across the United States. Okay, loose-knit group of 11 climate change activists, right? Who, you guys were part of a coordinated action. I really want to get to what you did because it's epic. It's biblical, if I could say. But I want to hand, that's a lot of talk. Let's say, I want to hand the talking stick to Lindsay and say, Lindsay, what is your take on, like, what should we be doing? And why don't more people have a sense of what's leading to this problem? Because here you are, you got the big flashlight. You're showing people what the problem is with the film that you're bringing. What do you think about that?
I don't claim to have an answer in terms of policy. The film is a very personal film. It's really about Ken and Ken's story and what drives him and how he got to that position. And my hope is that as the audience watches Ken's story unfold, they have moments of, you know, self-reflection in terms of their own ability to first even just think about the problem. It's such a scary topic that I think it's totally psychologically normal and perhaps, you know, healthy in the traditional sense to not think about it. But of course, that's not healthy for the planet or our actual lives. So we have to get to a point where we can not only think about it, but then talk about it and take action. And at this point, the people who are doing those things are a tiny, tiny minority, and Ken is one of them. He's certainly not the only one. But those people are supporting each other because they're in a lot of grief. And I think the rest of us can only think about it for a little bit before we sort of compartmentalize and turn it off and go about our daily business. And I think that's like a normal human behavior, but we have to reach a point as a society where we can talk about it, where we can actually face it together.
And in a minute, I want to talk about exactly what you did and what it was like. But Suzanne, you had a question.
Yeah, I just want to go back to talk a little bit about the process of how you got there, because you were somebody who did work within organizations. You also have children, you know, so you were somebody who has a lot of reason to stay on the side, on one side of the law, right? So I'm curious, yes. what happened, or what the process of thinking or events occurred that led you to this to take a kind of radical stand? What radicalized you?
I want to follow up on that and say, because the federal government now, and in this article that just came out a few days ago, the Fed, as far as the feds are concerned, you're a terrorist. So what made you take this step?
Well, I think my trajectory is different than most of my compatriots, who kind of generally came to it without any extensive political backgrounds. They tend to have somehow been confronted with the scale of the problem and freaked out, and then, you know, decided that they needed to take action. In my case, I feel like I've simply been doing the same thing I signed up to do from maybe age of 20 on. I mean, I've been working in, you know, I mean, I made a decision at a pretty young age that, having read some books like Small is Beautiful by E.F. Schumacher and others, that you know, we were in a situation where society, as we've planned it, was going to take us down the tubes, and we needed to do, and I wanted to spend my life trying to do the best I could to change that trajectory. So to me, this is merely a question of sort of tactics and strategy, not like I've changed my goals at all. I've been doing the same thing since I was a kid.
The
situation
has increased considerably.
Yes, the amount of risk to the globe has changed considerably in that period of time. And I think that those of us that are trying to address the thing need to adjust our own willingness to take risk, you know, accordingly. And if you're looking at the scope of the, you know, what's happening on the ground, and you're concluding that we're at a point where what we need is more disruption, and there aren't enough people engaging in disruption, then it's incumbent on us to do that or support it, mm-hmm. at least.
And just one other question. You mentioned that the thing that was missing from the environmental movement at the early 2000s was direct action, that piece mm-hmm. of activism. So two things. I know that at a different point in history, there has been more of a history of direct action. Do you have a sense of why that wasn't so much a practice at the time? And has that changed?
Well, nothing's changed at all, really, at all, in terms of numbers. We have additional people outside of our mainstream, you know, outside of U.S. environmentalism that are bringing more energy. But in terms of, you know, if we created the modern environmental movement to deal with this moment, right? I mean, that was the point, was to try to do what we could to stave off the worst. We are at that moment now, where decisions of the, you know, within a handful of years determine what the future, you know, whether we avoid cataclysm. And given that, whether our institutions survive, or there are people sitting around inside major organizations now, you know, figuring out 30-year investment plans for their endowments. That's absurd. We should be cashing out all of our money right now and spending it now, because 30 years from now, it's all over. So, you know, and within that is, if you're sitting there trying to ensure that your major nonprofit is going to grow and build and so forth, you're not thinking in terms of direct action.
Hey, I want to shift the frame a little bit and come back to how you planned to do it. you were part of a network of people across the country. And I think a lot of people, what you did is just, it's just radical. So can you describe, how did you meet the other valve turners?
We weren't part of a network. We were just individuals. We created a network of people to do this.
But there
this,
was so. Multiple actions at the same time.
Yes, there were five. There were five valve turners at four sites, which were determined to be the places where we could close down all tar sands oil coming into the U.S. at the same time in pipelines. The people we found by individual conversations. Some of us had known each other.
Wait, no. You were hanging at the plaid pantry at the soda fountain and you found five other people that were willing to take monkey wrenches. Come on now.
Yeah.
Come on now.
Essentially, yeah. I mean, we knew each other from other, you know, several of us had been engaged in the Anacortes Break Free action earlier in that year. So Emily Johnson, who one of the two women who turned the valves in Minnesota, I met Emily because she heard that I was going to go out and get in my boat and try to block the Fenneca. This is before I knew anything about what Greenpeace was planning or even the kayakism. I just had a dory. I was going to go block it. She heard that that was the case. She knew about the lobster boat action. She called me up and said, who are you doing this with? And I said, I'm doing it alone. I don't know any. I just moved out here. And she was like, okay, I'll come down. And she got in her car, drove down from Seattle, where she lives, to get into a dory with me and go out and try to block the Fenneca. That's how I met Emily.
Okay.
It's the equivalent of a 7-Eleven.
So, kind of, yeah, plaid pantry. So what were the states where the valves were? North Dakota, Minnesota, Washington State, Montana?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, it's the morning of. And now, I feel like I talked to someone who's done this before, and at some point, you valve turners literally... No, tell us how you do it.
Yeah, I'm really curious. Like, how do you close a pipe? I mean, is it above ground? Where is it?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of research and groundwork goes into it, both understanding how pipelines work, how pipeline safety protocols work, actually going in and looking at the things.
But and this is a big deal because the state laws that are trying to keep people from turning the pipe.
How do you even get close to one?
Well, he'll get to that in a second. But the people who are part of the industry, their big argument is it's so dangerous to do this. You endangered yourself. You were going to create an environmental catastrophe. The people in industry basically accuse the valve turners of being the people that were going to create an environmental problem. But anyway, that fascinates me. So talk about what it was like when you were there with the equipment and you were about to go in.
Well, to answer the earlier question, mm-hmm. to find it, you basically travel along the pipelines looking for these things that are called safety block valves, which are manual valves that enable you to shut down the pipeline in the event of an emergency when the centralized headquarters command center is, say, cut off for an earthquake or some reason. Or because there's a local spill and they just need to act quickly. That's what they're there for. So we find them by looking for them on the actual day, having identified these sites on each of the five places, and having traveled, you know, in some cases across several states to be there. In each of the sites, we had, we had one or two individuals that were going to turn the valves themselves and were the ones who were willing to assume that they'd be arrested. We also had independent videographers like Lindsay at each site who were there to document. And in some cases, we also had a supporter who was there often live streaming. And the live streaming was done as a safety measure for us, but also as a means for ensuring that the pipeline companies would believe that we were there. We did call them multiple times, not only from the site itself, we also had a central person in Seattle who called each of the pipeline companies before we went on to each of the sites to inform them. The point of all that is because what we wanted the companies to do was to shut down the pipelines themselves. That was far preferable. It's a safer, more efficient way of doing it. And as we know now from having gone through trials in all these cases, they in fact did it. Some of them did it faster. So in my case, the mere act of calling them to tell them that I was going to go in and shut down their site, they went ahead and shut it down. So by the time I got there, there was no oil flowing.
And that was in Washington
State?
That
was in Washington, okay. Yeah, outside of, in Skagit County.
Okay.
So in each of the cases, and we plan to do this in sequence, starting in Minnesota at several minute intervals across the country. So we informed the companies, the folks went into the sites. I think in all cases, we had to clip a chain that closed the valve itself. And then it varied, but in Minnesota, for example, they shut down the pipeline as Emily and Annette were actually closing the valve.
But just a question here. If you told them you were coming, and they knew you were coming, why weren't they there waiting for you, preventing you from even getting close?
Question number one.
Well, it was a very remote sites, so there was maybe some possibility of that, but we basically gave them 15 minutes. So it was enough time to close the pipeline safely, but not really enough time to get
call
anyone
the riot
on there to do anything.
I see. Okay.
So. And then, yeah, closed the valves. We brought our own chains and locks, so we locked it, demonstrating our... Because we had written a letter to President Obama saying, of course, this is necessary, and you should keep them shut. That was our policy outcome we were hoping for. And then to demonstrate our, you know, love for the earth and disdain for the ugliness of this all, we put flowers through the chains.
Mm. If you just tuned in, this is The Radio Activist. I'm Lisa Loving. I'm here with my friend and compatriot, Suzanne LeGrand. Our guests live in Studio 2 are Ken Ward and Lindsay Grazel. They are here with a new documentary film telling the story of an oil pipeline protester. That's Ken. The film is The Reluctant Radical. It screens tonight at St. Philip the Deacon Episcopal Church. 7 p.m. That's at 120 Northeast Knott Street. You know where it is. It's a wonderful place. And we're sitting here talking about the valve turners, how remarkable it is that we don't all know what a valve turner is, because that is amazing what this group of people did. And it's not just the turning of the valve. It's the documenting of the protest and bringing it to the public to just show, what people can do to try to bring attention to this issue. We talked a little bit about the actual act of the valve turning, which is amazing. I want to go back to Lindsay and say, Lindsay, what were some of the challenges of making this film?
Well, the biggest challenge is I didn't know how it was going to end. A lot of the films I've
made. We haven't even talked about what happened in court yet, because that was the wildest thing of all. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
A lot of the films I've made in the past have been historical or sort of a survey film where you know the storyline when you start filming. And, of course, we didn't know how this was going to end. So that was the biggest challenge. In terms of filming the actions themselves, I consulted with lawyers to be careful that I wasn't myself breaking the law. And so there were a lot of things that I had to do in order to capture the images that it would have been much easier if I wasn't worried about that. I did not follow Ken into the enclosure. I really wanted to, because it would have been a much better image. I mean, we were far away, and we had to be up above a 6-foot fence and chain link and all that to get the image and change lenses. And we even brought step stools so we could put the camera tripod up and see over the fence, things like that, just logistic stuff. And then all the challenges that come with making an independent film, which is, you know, mainly funding and distribution, because you don't have a company behind you.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
Of course, that after Ken turned the valve, my camera person and I were also arrested and charged with the same charges that Ken was charged with, and so that lack of institutional support was extremely challenging at that time, to not have, you know, a company to fall back on and lawyers to swoop in. But I will say that our community of independent filmmakers here in Portland totally rallied. I got two awesome pro bono lawyers in Washington State. My camera person, we were able to fundraise to pay his lawyer, and it was right after Trump was elected, and I think we got all the money in about 4 days. So I was real happy that we had, you know, the support of the community behind us.
Incredible, because that's the point that you're making of, I mean, so this is what I want to come to. You guys didn't have, say, Greenpeace behind you writing checks and giving everybody a t-shirt and a ride on the Rainbow Warrior or anything like that.
No.
You guys were so grassroots. That, in a way, that's maybe why you were able to turn the valves. And I do want to come out and say, I'm not sure if any of the valve turners anywhere have actually been convicted of any federal crimes or anything like that. It looks like this piece that I'm reading from, the people who were more recent from Minnesota, they were not convicted either. So in other words, there's an incredible cadre of unbelievably brave people who are facing being blown up, actually. Let's be real.
I wouldn't agree with that.
What was the worst? Okay, Ken, what was the most dangerous physical thing that could happen to you besides at the hands of the police?
The most dangerous thing that could have happened in terms of a pipeline would have been a spill. The history has demonstrated, because we now have extensive history of people doing this, that we've had no spills of any kind anywhere. And mostly I think that's because people have in fact followed a protocol similar to, and we didn't invent this protocol, by the way. It was the activists in Canada that figured out how to do this, and we followed their lead, which is the point of our list is to provide a credible threat to the pipeline companies so that their own safety protocols kick in and they shut the pipeline down. And that's what's happened in all of these cases. So.
And just a question about how you conceive of direct action in this instance. So you go in knowing that you're going to be arrested.
And committed to nonviolence.
We actually went in making a determination to stand. In some of our cases, I think Leonard had to wait around 45 minutes before he was arrested. Had we wanted to go in and shut them down and leave, we could have.
Uh-huh. And why did you decide to stay?
We thought it was, it was a combination of reasons. Partly it's personal, and each of us made for me it was an ethical decision that if I was going to take that action, I wanted to stand and take the consequences. Quite apart from any, political value out of that. We also thought that because it's the first time it was happening in the U.S. and because we knew that, charges of eco-terrorism would be thrown around, that it was important for us to stand and be arrested, face the charges, explain why we're doing this, explain the need and the contingencies, and sort of demonstrate that our motives are not terroristic, quite the reverse. Our aim here is to avoid terror, which is what's overall what's happening.
It's so interesting.
That was crucial.
Because we had the ELF, ALF, the Earth Liberation Front, and the Animal Liberation Front were all movements that passed through Portland. People, and in those cases, people did say, for example, blow up the Ross Island sand and gravel trucks and then leave. And what happened with all those cases is that the individuals that did the direct action were demonized and the whole thing turned into a sort of a whack-a-mole. Mm-hmm. And the point of why they did that was completely lost, 100% completely lost, which is interesting. But now I want to shift gears again and say what happened in court, because this is the whole point. Like your whole point that committing a crime was in the public interest. Talk about what did the judge decide? What happened when you went to court, Ken?
And also, what were you charged with officially? I'm curious.
Before I do that, can I also note that it's not just showing tonight, but it's also showing 2 weeks from now at the Clinton Theater, and particularly anyone who's interested from an activist point of view, we'd encourage you to go to that, because there'll be a panel discussion with some friends of mine from Extinction Rebellion US there. So a lot of the things we're talking about here will get discussed there in more detail.
It's also showing this Friday at Catlin Gable.
We're talking about the film, The Reluctant film. Yeah. Radical, which is going to be showing tonight. But that's why
and
we're
we'll
here
both
talking
be there
about
too.
But anyway.
So the, I was charged initially with five charges in Washington, and those were eventually whittled down to two, burglary and sabotage. We attempted, or my lawyers asked for to be able to present what's called a necessity defense, which is a part of the common law in the U.S., in which you are allowed to explain to the jury that, yes, you did the thing that you're nominally charged with, but that you did it for the purpose of avoiding a greater harm. It's a kind of a common sense defense. We were denied that. I was denied that right. And so, when I went to trial, it was on the narrow question of, did I go into this enclosure? Did I cut a lock? Did I close? Turn the valve? The judge in my case allowed me, as a defendant speaking from the stand, to get into the questions of why I did it, but only from the point of view of how did it affect my state of mind. So every question I got asked about science had to be phrased, and I had to remember to answer it in terms of how it affected my state of mind. But after a fairly short trial in which I wasn't allowed to call any of the experts that I would have been called, like climate expert, climate scientists, we had a hung jury. So a portion of that jury, in some ways, agreed with my case, or just thought that the government side hadn't proved itself, which was unlikely because they showed, the prosecution showed Lindsay's video of me doing what I was charged with. So as the prosecutor said in both trials, there really wasn't any question of fact here. The normal thing you spend your time on in trial is the question of motives. That was the first trial. They tried me again. And in the second trial, I had another hung jury on the charge of sabotage, and I was convicted on the charge of burglary and given a month's worth of community service, which I did at Habitat for Humanity in Skagit County. That conviction was appealed on the basis that I wasn't allowed a necessity defense, and we're waiting for the appeals court decision on that now, which we're actually somewhat hopeful for based on how the appeals arguments went. If I win that, then presumably I would go back to Skagit County for a third trial, again on the same two charges.
Can they try you endless times for the same crimes?
As long as I am neither convicted or win, if I get hung juries, yeah, they could keep trying me on that.
Wow.
The law is pretty fascinating as it relates to activism. I would put that out.
Yeah.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to The Radio Activist. I'm Lisa. I'm here with my friend and compatriot, Suzanne. We're speaking live with Ken Ward and Lindsay Grazel about their film, The Reluctant Radical. It's going to be playing around town the next week or two. Tonight it's at St. Philip, the Deacon Episcopal Church. It's going to be at Clinton Street. It's going to be at Catlin Gable. I want to put it to you, Ken and Lindsay, you're an activist, okay? Are there other movements that you created common cause with as you did this work? People doing other activities that you admire and that you made friends with and that you fist pumped to each other across a distance?
Well, this particular action I made was done, at the time of and fundamentally affected by the fight at Standing Rock. We were very careful and concerned to do. The action itself, the genesis of it, was not Standing Rock. The time we chose to do it, was in response to a call from Standing Rock for a week of action and prayer. So we chose to do this action at that time with the statement that we were doing it in solidarity with the folks at Standing Rock. So that was the most important. And then beyond that, we aren't an organization. We're a collection of individuals. People do all kinds of different things. And choosing, what else you work on and who you do it in solidarity with is very much an individual thing. Annette Klapstein is hugely involved in juvenile justice, the efforts to reform juvenile justice in Seattle and to shut down an effort to create a new juvenile jail up there. It's like a big, a big concern of hers, for example.
There's another group too, the five environmental activists from Seattle who tried to block the oil trains. They were called the Delta 5.
Delta 5, yeah.
And that's Michael LaPointe. Patrick Mazza, who actually used to be a Portlander and used to be the editor of the Portland Alliance, not related to Dave Mazza, which is hilarious. Jackie Minshew, Elizabeth Sperry, and Abigail Brockway. So there are groups in different places doing similar things. That is amazing. And they tried that. They tried that same kind of defense, but they failed in their legal case. But the judge in that case of the Delta 5 basically said, but you guys are doing the right thing, which is hilarious. What were you going to say, Suzanne?
Yeah, I'm just interested about the role of media in redefining the nature of the meaning of this action, right? Because we know that, you know, if this, and I don't even know if, was this reported on mainstream news?
It was largely ignored. There were a few reports that were, interestingly, mostly in the business journals.
The business journals. Oh, fascinating.
Reuters did a story, but I think it was, do you remember that?
I mean, over time, especially as we got into trials, we have gotten, you know, substantially more mainstream media than anybody else doing this. I mean, we were on the cover of the New York Times Magazine, as one example. We have never been covered in mainstream television, the main way that, you know, things get communicated. All of this, I have seen a shift in as the mainstream media has kind of disintegrated and resources have been reduced. I mean, we got altogether much less attention from this action as we got during the lobster boat blockade, which was only a few years ago, and it's been a significant shift.
Certainly a lot of progressive media outlets like Democracy Now! have done the story and that sort of thing. But in the immediate aftermath, I guess Democracy Now! Did step in, but there were a lot of business journals that seemed to report on how easy it was to sabotage the nation's oil pipelines.
And it looks like an industry group rose up to counter valve turners, and that one of the things that one of these industry groups has done is it started to keep a database of all the people that have messed around with the pipeline, which is pretty fascinating that a leftist group didn't do that. But I mean, I guess that goes
an industry group keep tabs on individuals?
Well, they're keeping tab on their workplace. They're keeping tabs on all of the cases where someone has messed up with, has been charged with messing with a pipeline. I mean, why would they not?
Yeah, there's been a sequence of a concerted response from pipeline companies. Monitoring is one. They also drafted a piece of model state legislation dealing with pipeline infrastructure and energy infrastructure, which they have now caused to be introduced in 18 states, and I believe it's passed in three, and it's moving through three or four other states. South Dakota at the moment is, the governor is pressing to have that particular bill. That further criminalizes anything having to do with pipeline infrastructure like we engaged in, and it expands it beyond the individuals who are engaged to specifically target any organizations that provided support for that, because the right wing and the pipeline companies believe that this is all comes from George Soros. So we all sit around laughing, like, where's our check from George?
Because,
you know,
George?
We did ourselves, we paid for it from our own retirement accounts. I mean, nobody gave us jack. So it'd be great if we were getting checks from somewhere. That's kind of hilarious. And there also was an effort, or I think still ongoing effort, to press the federal government to take action. Last fall, we had a letter from 84 members of Congress that went to then Attorney General Jeff Sessions, specifically mentioning the valve turning action in Standing Rock, and asking if the federal government shouldn't have stronger laws, and why the Attorney General wasn't taking action against this.
I think it's remarkable that there's not specifically a federal law at this time. It looks like American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, has tried to draft language, and a few states have gone for that, but it's fascinating to me. But what are we going to say, Suzanne?
Yeah, I just wanted to go back to the question of how media can be a kind of social activism, because, of course, you know, as a documentary filmmaker, part of I'm assuming that part of the reason you are doing this is because you want to get this story out to people.
Absolutely.
How do you see using media as a way of helping change people's perceptions, both about direct activism and also about the kind of the larger question of what we need to do?
Well, I think there's, you know, there's a lot of different types of media, and what I was just talking about in terms of not getting a lot of attention immediately after the action, you know, my work is not usually in that realm. I'm not someone who churns out, you know, 5-minute videos or 2-minute videos that go on Facebook or Instagram and that people watch and learn about these things. I do long form documentaries. So where I'm coming from, my work is all about providing context. So to really delve deep into motivations and to tap into people's emotions and try and reach their hearts, which I don't think you can do very effectively in a 2-minute Facebook video. You can inform, you can let people know that something has happened, which is, you know, very important and crucial. But what my work tends to do, or at least what I hope it's doing, is reaching people on a different level, an emotional level with context.
You know what's interesting? No, go ahead.
Well, it's been amazing. It's tremendously effective, this movie. I mean, if I look at how I spend my time, I'm at the moment spending maybe 4 or 5 times a week. I am speaking to an audience that's just seen Lindsay's movie. Most of them are scattered. At this point, they're scattered around the world. So I have like one on Friday where I'm calling in for a video conference with people in Sweden. And I got one on Sunday that's in Zurich. In any given day, I'll be like stopping what I'm doing, sit down in front of my computer, and suddenly I'll be talking to 50 people in some church basement somewhere who's just seen the movie and who all know me, which is kind of weird because they've just seen the movie. But it is by far the most effective. This movie is the most effective documentary. It's the most effective means we have of disseminating the action itself and what we did and what the consequences are. And that is, I think, a damning indictment of our media overall. It's not considered newsworthy, what we did, but people are clearly interested because they are themselves gathering together, to find out about it.
You know what I was going to say a few minutes ago? What fascinates me the most, though, because I deal with so many journalists and so many media outlets, and I've helped people do public relations for their events and stuff. I mean, to me, a lot of this stuff boils down to there's nobody at the TV station that even knows what this is. Literally, like the assignment editor has a headache, and she, it's almost certainly a female human being, I'm here to tell you, is stressed out, and she's worrying about this and this and this and that, and she doesn't even have time to draw a circle around what in the world could be climate change. And so the opposite of the question you asked, Suzanne, fascinates me the most. How about media that's not curious, that's lazy, and overwhelmed by its nature? Is that part of, like, to what degree does that make climate change more inevitable? Fascinates me. Mm-hmm. Because even if I'm just looking at what used to be the daily newspaper here in our town, which has not been a daily in years, there's so few people on the news staff. We could invite them to my house for dinner tonight, Suzanne. We could invite all of the reporters at what used to be the daily newspaper to my house, and they would all fit around the table, I'm saying. There's so few people. This blows my mind. And that's why independent journalists who are willing to really sacrifice yourself financially and professionally, that's a pretty heavy lift for you, Lindsay. Who do you admire? Who do you see who's also doing the kind of work that you do that we should all go out and find now? Because we don't know all of the yous out there.
Well, there's a lot of us, actually. I certainly admire all the activists for what they're doing. But if you're talking about
independent filmmakers,
there are lots and lots and lots of us. Go to your local film festival and meet them. They're there with their films. We have 3 or 4 film festivals here in Portland where you can meet people. And most of us are working, you know, just basically with our own savings. We might get a small grant here and there. We have helpers. We help each other out on our projects when we can. But we do it mostly because we love to do it and we hope that it makes a difference.
But we should mention Daya Schlossberg.
For sure. So Daya Schlossberg is my co-producer on this project. And we actually met because she was the one filming Michael Foster. And she was also arrested after the action. And so afterwards, we connected, and she agreed to come on the project. She's worked a lot with Josh Fox on how to love the world and all the things climate can't change. And she is currently working on a really interesting project called Bootstraps, which is about universal basic income. You should check that out.
We have a few people in the KABU building that are talking about universal basic income and how it can reduce crime and all kinds of other things. Michael Foster was another valve turner. He was the only one who went to jail. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. So I just wanted to make it clear who we're all talking about. I wanted to take a minute because we're talking about political prisoners, kind of. We're talking about Ken Ward could have been a political prisoner. I wanted to take a minute and just name the water protector political prisoners who were incarcerated for their resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline and its threats to the Missouri River and Standing Rock. That's Michael Littlefeather Giron, Red Fawn Fallis, Dion Ortiz, Michael Rattler Marcus, James Angry Bird White, and I just had to name them because there are some people that have gone to prison, and these were not valve turners. They were there at, I think that they were handcuffed to the equipment at Standing Rock. Mm-hmm. We got about 3 more minutes. Okay, we've gone through a lot, but this is what I want to ask you. There's other Standing Rocks out there. There's other valves to be turned, right? There's people listening right now. There could be even kids listening right now. What advice would you give them, Ken?
Well, I think that I never advise anybody to either engage or not engage in, you know, high-risk direct action. That's a personal choice that I hope a lot of people wrestle with at the very least. I do ask that people engage in the greatest level of disruption that they are capable of doing around climate change. And there's a whole, you know, and people tend to think about this as, oh, well, I couldn't do that, I couldn't turn a valve and take that kind of risk, and then think that it's sort of an either or binary choice. But there's not. There's a whole range of disruptions. And we need to see it happening at all levels. One of the best examples of it is almost anybody anywhere can find an institution that they have some connection to and figure out whether or not they continue to have an investment in fossil fuel, and if they don't, seek to get them to divest. That's disruptive. So there's a range of things that people can do. I mentioned earlier I'm supporting the launch of Extinction Rebellion in the U.S. That was an effort launched in the U.K. over the last year, which does, in fact, discuss the scale of the problem and the size of the solution in appropriate terms and demands action, immediate action from government on a timeline. So that's one way people can search out, you know, their local entities like Extinction Rebellion or 350 and get involved there.
How about you, Lindsay? You're our media activist right now. What's your advice to people?
My advice is the same, to get involved. And there's a lot of different ways to get involved, both philosophically and risk-taking. Tonight at the church, we're going to have representatives from Extinction Rebellion there. We'll also have people from 350 PDX and Citizens Climate Lobby. So 3 very different organizations all working on climate change from different perspectives and strategies.
350.org kicks butt around here. I just want to shout out to them. They are they're one of the sponsors of the film. And I have to say, a couple years ago, all of the climate change organizations and nonprofits and activists formed a coalition in the city around here, and that KABU News was the only outlet that covered it. That's the most radical thing of all. When people come together and cooperate, that doesn't happen enough. So anyway, we're just going to close out this show, and I do have to say, for more information on The Reluctant Radical, go there online, thereluctantradical.org.
No, .com.
.com. Okay, .com. Thereluctantradical.com. Tonight, the event is at St. Philip the Deacon. It's at 7, and that is at 120 Northeast Knott Street, okay? Look it up on their Facebook and on their website for their shows at the Clinton Street Theater and in Catlin Gable. Extinction Rebellion can be found at rebellion.earth. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Heather McCoy. Also, the KABU volunteer coordinator is Ani Haynes. Radical inclusion is her game. Contact her to be a volunteer at this radio station. volunteer@kabu.fm. You could be behind this mic. We are radioactive. Thanks for being here with me, Suzanne.
Thank you for listening.
And stay tuned.
KBOO is looking for a grant writer to join our team. We are seeking someone with a proven track record in writing successful, complex proposals for diverse sources of grant funding. Previous experience working in the philanthropic landscape of the Portland metro area is preferred, and previous experiences working with community media organizations and with communities of color are A+. This is a one-year contract position for a total of 200 hours at $25 an hour, and the grant writer will work closely with the KBOO Development Director. For more information, go to our website at kboo.fm and click on the KBOO is hiring link on the right side of the home page.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Forest Defense Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project annual benefit on Saturday, March 16th from 7 to 10 p.m. at Cider Riot in Portland. The Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project has been working to protect and restore the ecosystems of the Blue Mountains in Eastern Oregon Cascades since 1991. This annual benefit party features DJs, speakers, cider, and more. Again, that's the Forest Defense Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project annual benefit on Saturday, March 16th, 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland. And up next is Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, the Dirt Bag. Host Glenn Anderson welcomes world traveler Jim Gilbert, who will report on his recent trip to China, searching for tasty and appropriate plants to grow here. All this KBOO programming is made possible by member support. If you want to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click donate. And now Flashpoints.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California.